Well, Kurt gave an excellent overview of the evidence for radio emission from supernovae and what we can say from that point of view. I'll be talking about some similar topics, but starting from the point of view of what we think the physical situation is like within the supernovae and what we might expect as far as the emission that results from that situation. So the kinds of stars we're talking about are massive stars, and here this is just showing the various classes of supernovae that one might expect. This is a function of stellar mass along the bottom, initial mass and metallicity along here. So if you look up here, if you look at single stars, the type 2Ps and the 2Ls explode as red supergiants, so highly extended stars. One gets increasing mass loss along here, ending up with the 1BCs over here, which have lost their hydrogen, end up as more compact stars, which can be have some effects for the emission that one sees. So this is for single stars. One would expect many more of the type 2Ps and 1BCs than we actually seem to see. So in fact, many of the 1BCs may come from binary systems which lose their envelope through those interactions. But there's increasing mass loss as one goes along here, so that these explode with quite dense circumstellar media, lower density here, and these of course are more compact stars with fast winds. The shockwave propagates through the star as a result of the explosion. When the shock gets to the outer parts of the star, there's shock acceleration, which gives rise to steep power law for the density distribution. The shock acceleration stops when the radiation can begin to escape from the radiation-dominated shock. So if you have a more compact star, you can reach higher velocities because the shock wave stays optically thick for a longer period of time. So then there's radiative acceleration out ahead of the shock. The shock wave goes away for a bit, but then this very fast material eventually catches up with the circumstellar medium, which is out here. There's a shock wave which forms, and then one gets a sort of slowing down shock structure which goes out into the circumstellar medium. For the more compact stars like Wolf-Rayet stars, one can expect maximum velocities, if you take a typical energy of 10 to the 51 ergs, of something like 100,000 kilometers per second. So the maximum velocity that one gets at this point, it will then slow down as it interacts with the surrounding medium. So unless you have a very energetic event, you don't get relativistic velocities at the time of shock breakout for a Wolf-Rayet explosion. For things like the red supergiant explosions, the maximum velocities that you can attain are more like 15 to 20,000 kilometers per second because of the greater extent that the star has. So there's this power law which forms on the outside that will run into the surrounding medium. You can describe the power law in a freely expanding gas where the velocity of an element of gas stays constant with time. The density drops as t to the minus 3 just due to the spherical expansion, and that runs into a wind which has the density going as r to the minus 2. And over the times of interest, at least for the type 1BCs, one expects the part of the star which is running into the surrounding wind to be this outer steep power law, which has an index of order 9 or 10, and that leads to the shock radius expanding as time to the 0.9 power. This exponent that one has with time here has to be somewhere between 2/3 and 1, but for the conditions we expect, it'll be around 0.9. So you run into the surrounding medium. This is a simulation by John Blondin showing the outer shock front here. This is the reverse shock. 3D calculation looked at in projection here, and so one has instabilities at the reverse shock, end up with something that looks a bit like Cas A, which I think is a wind interaction supernova. This simulation I showed covered several orders of magnitude in time. Maybe we'll just do it once more. But it's always scaled back so that the radius stays the same. One has these instabilities at the reverse shock. The forward shock stays quite stable here. Okay, so if you look at the radio emission that you'd expect from this case, if you have some percentage of the post-shock energy going to magnetic field and relativistic electrons, those assumptions one finds both in the GRB and going back much further in the supernova game. For the kinds of conditions, at least in the high velocities you get in a type 1BC, one expects synchrotron self-absorption to be the most important process for absorbing the early emission. And since it's a power law, everything's a power law, there's no, it's a scale-free problem, so one expects sort of scale-free radio light curves in that case, where it's just synchrotron self-absorption. But there, as Kurt mentioned, there are other processes that can be important. There's external free-free absorption, which could give a steeper part of the power law. There's cooling by synchrotron, cooling of the electrons. Inverse Compton cooling can affect the spectrum of the electrons, and Coulomb losses. Klaus will talk more about those processes later on. But for the type 1 BCs, one might expect to have this very simple case here if you do get these high-velocity shocks where the synchrotron self-absorption dominates, and as Kurt showed, this case of 94i, where in fact it does seem to fit very well with a simple synchrotron self-absorption, well, not exactly, but fits quite well with the synchrotron self-absorption model. Radius going is t to the 0.9. One has a nu to the minus 1 spectrum in this case. So this, as he mentioned, this seems to be the best case. In other cases, it does seem to be true that synchrotron self-absorption is the dominant process, though, for the 1BCs. So if you have synchrotron self-absorption, you can derive the radius at the time of the peak of the light curve using synchrotron theory. It does depend on the ratio of the energy density in electrons to the energy density in magnetic field, but only to the 1/19th power. So it's not very sensitive to that particular, to assuming that those are equal to each other. And this is the fraction of the volume which is occupied by the radio-emitting region. That's about 0.5 for standard models like the one I showed, but that again comes into a small power. So if you look at where the supernovae lie, this is a plot of time of peak of the radio emission versus the luminosity at the peak. So you can plot all the various supernovae on here, and then these dashed lines going across here, assuming that synchrotron self-absorption is the dominant process for the absorption, then it tells you something about the velocities at the time of that peak radio emission. So this is 10,000 kilometers per second, this is 100,000 here. And one finds that the different types of supernovae sort themselves out into different places in this kind of a diagram here. So starting at the top, 98BW distinguishes it itself. There are other radio supernovae that are comparably bright, but it distinguishes itself by turning on very early, which implies a very high velocity. So it's sort of in the relativistic velocity range here. And so I said that doesn't happen for an ordinary type 1 BC supernova. So the two possibilities are this has something to do with the gamma ray burst, which was associated with the supernova, or it has something to do with a very high energy explosion that, of course, helps to get higher velocities at the outer edge of the star at the time of shock breakout. Then one has the type 1 BCs along this region here. So these are in the range. In fact, O2AP should be over here someplace. That had velocities probably in excess of 70,000 kilometers per second. There's a wide range in luminosity here for the 1BCs. They're all fairly high velocity, though, around 30,000 kilometers per second. So that's higher than the velocities one gets in the red supergiant explosions. And this range here, you can explain it. The thing is, if synchrotron self-absorption is the most important process, it's you don't get a direct estimate of the mass loss density in the surrounding gas as you do a free-free absorption is. So you have to assume something about how strong the magnetic field is and so forth. But just to, if you want to get this sort of range in luminosities to be produced by the range in mass loss densities, and this is about a factor of 1,000, it's somewhat larger than the range in mass loss densities we see around galactic Wolf-Rayet A stars. If you look in terms of A stars, which is scaled to 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year, for 1,000 kilometers per second, what we see in galactic Wolf-Rayet stars is something like 0.05 to 7 or so. One has to have a somewhat larger range. And you also have to have the epsilon B, the efficiency of putting energy into magnetic field, about 0.1, then to have the range of densities you see in galactic Wolf-Rayet stars to produce this range in type 1 BCs you see here. The other types, there's a couple of types of type 2 Bs. O1IG showed hydrogen in its spectrum, but it seems to have exploded as a Wolf-Rayet star, and it had high velocities, also the optical characteristics imply it was a Wolf Rayet star, probably had just a small amount of hydrogen. O3BG is in this category also. 93J had of order a tenth of a solar mass, had dense mass loss, had a red supergiant progenitor. The type 2Ls have maybe more like a solar mass. They come down here. And then as you go to the type 2Ps, which have been studied more recently, they have lower mass loss densities and come out down here. There's some stars here. Of course, the velocities seem to be much lower than you'd expect for a supernova. All that's telling you is that some other absorption process is giving rise to the fairly late peak here. If that other absorption process wasn't there, they'd come out over here, eventually running into the synchrotron self-absorption line. So the deduction for the type 1 BCs, where we have a range something like 94i, there's some range of radius around the star that one can investigate. There's this new to the one spectrum going as indicating the energy index of 3. But the velocity near peak is about a tenth C. And if one assumes this epsilon B of order 0.1, which is a fairly high value, the densities are comparable to those of galactic Wolf Rayet stars. One of the faintest ones was 2002 AP, and which was talked about the last couple of days. So the radio data on this one, because it was so faint, is not all that great. There is an early XMM point. It was quite low luminosity in the X-ray also. There is certainly a correlation between X-ray and radio that we see from the supernova. There's some range also. It's not exact. So Bjornsson and Franson interpreted the X-ray emission, which was seen quite early on, as being inverse Compton of the photospheric emission being upscattered by the relativistic electrons that give rise to the radio emission. And so if you take the parameters that you need for the radio emission and then put in and then assume rough equipartition between magnetic field and electrons, what in fact gets the X-ray luminosity that was observed. And the same sort of thing seems to work in the handful of other type 1 BC supernovae that have been observed at early times. So if you assume we do think these are Wolf Rayet stars, have low density winds, thermal emission from the interaction is way too low to explain what you see in X-rays. If you just extrapolate the radio emission to X-rays, that comes out too low. It's even worse if you put in synchrotron cooling, which should be there. And so from those arguments, one finds that inverse Compton seems to work fairly well. But there is one of these, an interesting observation with Chandra. This is probably the latest observation of 94i at any wavelength within X-rays in about 7 years showed up here. So this is certainly not inverse Compton because the supernova is extremely faint at this time. There's not enough of a photon source. So one thing Klaus and I have been thinking out is that you could have, in fact, synchrotron emission if you don't have a constant power law going up to high energies. And if one has a cosmic ray dominated shock, as Don Ellison will probably talk about tomorrow, that the higher energy particles see a higher shock jump, and that will give rise to a flatter spectrum at higher energies. So if you have among the relativistic electrons, if they have Lorentz factors less than about 1,000, which puts them into this region here, which is what we expect for the type 1 BC supernovae, then one gets a fairly steep power law for the electrons, and in fact steeper than the test particle limit, which would correspond to P equal 2, or a new to the 0.5 spectrum. That in fact is what we see for the type 1 BCs. And then if you go to high energy particles, in fact one gets somewhat flatter than the test particle limit because of the higher shock compression that those particles are seeing. So if you put in this kind of a spectrum, you get the flattening. You will eventually, of course, get the synchrotron cooling for the particles, but one can then get the X-rays into the regime where they appear to be present. 494i, and it may play a role with some of the earlier observations of the type 1 BCs also. So what we think is there is some evidence for cosmic ray dominated shock. The velocities here, as I say, around a tenth C or so. And so you get the steeper spectrum for the radio-emitting particles, and then you need to have the flattening to be able to explain the X-rays. We heard yesterday some about the attempts to see emission from type 1 BCs at late times if they have a jet which is slowed down and eventually give rise to more isotropic radio emission. Alicia talked about her efforts in this direction. There's been a couple groups working on it, and Stockdale et al. Found this interesting supernova 2001 EM, which was seen as a type 1 BC at early time, and then turned into something, as Kurt was mentioning, seems to be more like a type 2N. In fact, Alicia et al. Did find an H-alpha line from this event. But it did start out as a type 1 BC. And then it appeared to be climbing in radio. This is the flux it would have if it were at the distance of 1987A. So at least the early data seemed to be indicating was it climbing as an optically thin source, which is what we've seen in 1987A also. Many orders of magnitude higher in luminosity. So it is very much in the same regime where one sees these bright type 2Ns like 1986J. And what you need to get this kind of bright emission is to have the supernova mass running into a comparable amount of mass, a relatively small radius, because you have to be able to turn the supernova energy into internal energy at a relatively early time. So this requires a shell or something which is about a factor of 10 smaller than the shell we see around 1987A, a radius something like 10 to the 17 centimeters. You have to have a shell mass about equal to the ejecta mass, a few solar masses or so. And that implies very strong mass loss on a time scale of something like 1,000 years before the explosion. So in this case, it did start out as a type 1 BC, and then it turned into something where it turned into a type 2 because it ran into the hydrogen envelope that it ejected at an earlier time. If you have this kind of situation happening, this is for shocked interstellar gas, you could have shocked circumstellar gas here, then one expects a wind bubble. There's also, we've heard about the past couple of days, forming within the shell. So the Wolf-Rayet wind in this case would have passed through a shock front at some relatively small radius, because this is out at 10 to the 17 or so, and then gone to a more constant density medium out here. So there's some supernovae, the 01IG and 03BG, which are not well behaved like 94I is, but show, once they turn optically thin, this jump in the radio flux. So that's indicative of running into a density jump, a factor of 2 or 3 or something like that. If one explains that just by structure within the Wolf-Rayet wind, it requires a time scale from the time of the explosion of, as Alicia mentioned, something like 20 years or so. They're very similar jumps seen in these two events, although IG was somewhat fainter and had synchrotron self-absorption turn on at a somewhat earlier time. So one thing I think about, well, could this be due to an interaction with the termination shock of the wind if it did have some kind of a dense shell out there that it's running into? These are stars that seem to have exploded as Wolf-Rayet stars but had some hydrogen on them still, indicating they hadn't been Wolf-Rayet stars for a very long time. But then it becomes hard to explain the continued rather steep drop one sees after this jump here. One would expect things much flatter, even increasing. And also, this interaction keeps going for a long time, and it should eventually hit this dense shell, which is at the outer part of the bubble. So this jump in flux here in this particular feature remains kind of puzzling. One sees a very similar feature in 98BW, in fact, which Lee and I interpreted as energy coming from the central engine, in this case associated with the GRB. That's clearly not what's happening in these type 1 BCs here. So that was one of the arguments, that the radio emission is due to the central engine in this case. We seem to have lost that particular argument. And I think it's still not completely clear whether BW radio emission is due to the central engine, or perhaps could be produced by a very energetic supernova accelerating the outer edge of the star. The X-ray emission from BW is very flat in its evolution. And one expects something like that, again, in this picture where there's structure in the relativistic electron spectrum. So it's kind of a flat region and then steepening again. One can get quite a bit flatter evolution in the X-rays than in the radio. The radio is much steeper for BW, so there is a possibility still, I think, that this is synchrotron emission, even though it falls well above the extrapolation of the radio emission that one sees. Okay, getting to GRBs, we've heard something about this already, as Sri pointed out in his first talk, that the modeling of multi-wavelength afterglow evolution is generally not consistent with interaction with the wind, which is consistent with everything we see from the supernova interpretation of the 1BCs. And then jet breaks, if you see a sharp jet break, as Jonathan said, it's hard to do that if you're interacting with the wind. Both the amount of steepening is too small and happens over too long a period of time. So if you need to run into a dense or a constant density medium, the most plausible way of doing that around a massive star is if the shock, there's a termination shock that the wind has passed through. The problem is if you just put in sort of standard numbers, again, this is the A star is the wind density scale to 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year, 1,000 kilometers per second. P over K is essentially the density times the temperature. So taking a typical pressure one sees in the interstellar medium, you'd get a very large radius for the termination shock. To explain things in GRBs, you'd have to get into like 10 to the 17 centimeters or less. So people have been trying to think of ways to, you have to either reduce or both reduce the density of the wind or greatly increase the pressure of the region that the wind is expanding into. And these are some of the ideas that have been tossed around. When it was unclear for a while just how the mass loss rate depends on metallicity. There were some stars where it seemed not, some types of Wolf-Rayet stars, it didn't seem to depend on the metallicity. Now it seems clear that there is a dependence, perhaps as one assumes for other massive stars, it goes as z to the 0.5. And then there's various ways of increasing the pressure. One is just if you have the star in a very high pressure starburst region where there's a lot of stars giving winds and supernovae, one in fact can get pressures of order P over K of order 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8, which greatly reduces the radius that the termination shock has. Or if you have a recent transition to a Wolf-Rayet star, so you still have some dense region of mass loss around, like we saw in 2001 EM, then the termination shock will be far in also. Then you'd have to explain, well, why does the Wolf-Rayet star Wolf-Rayet explode as a gamma ray burst at this particular soon after it's become a Wolf-Rayet star? That could be that during the Wolf-Rayet evolution, it spins down, so you only have the high angular momentum quite early on. We can make a story like that. The other area where interesting information is being obtained now in the Swift era is for absorption lines, and there's a few absorption line studies which have shown high velocity absorption, 1,000 to 3,000 kilometers per second, which is most naturally identified as the Wolf-Rayet wind velocity. The problems that one runs into is that there's strong photoionization by the gamma ray burst radiation. So here one is forced in the opposite problem, whereas for the afterglows, we're trying to explain the kind of termination shock far in. For the wind, interpreting absorption in terms of the Wolf-Rayet wind, you have to have the termination shock way far out because you have to have enough wind that it all doesn't get fully ionized by the radiation coming from the GRB. So it's kind of, you're forced in different directions here. And this whole area remains kind of murky. There's also the question of whether there's some other way of producing these velocities here, perhaps radiative acceleration of clumps around the Wolf-Rayet star. The other interesting thing has been the observation of fine structure lines seen in absorption. And their analysis of the lines have indicated temperatures of a few thousand degrees and very high densities. So that implies a P over K greater than 10 to the 8. That is a very high pressure. So to get these kinds of lines here, and this does seem to be in the vicinity somewhere of the gamma ray burst, so one has some evidence that, in fact, at least some of the bursts are occurring in a very high pressure environment, which would certainly affect the immediate circumstellar environment that the source has. Okay, so these are some conclusions, the thing about the type 1BCs that I already said. And then the gamma ray burst, so this problem has been around for quite a few years now, that the evidence for the constant density is still puzzling. I mean, we still think the best bet is a shocked wind, and various people have worked on it. There's some nice poster here by Allard von Marl and Norbert Langer showing some of the things that one can expect around a Wolf-Rayet stars. But there's still no evidence. One would like to see this transition from a wind to an interstellar medium type evolution for the afterglow. There was some hope of that being seen in the Swift era with the very early observations being made, but that hasn't happened yet for a variety of reasons. Okay, thank you.
Would you be kind enough to put the X-ray afterglow that you have shown? It would be easier to make
the
comment.
One with all the light curves, this one?
Not the radio, that's right. Keep it, just hold it a minute. What I would like to point out is that the X-ray is exactly the X-ray afterglow. It's falling fastly, then become flat. And then you didn't show recent data of, I believe, of Chandra and XMM Newton, where it suddenly falls again. I would like just to point out that the time scale in BW is actually in the observer frame. If it is off-axis viewing of an observer, it's actually time dilated by a Doppler factor squared. If you take this Doppler factor from the ratio of the normal luminosity gamma ray burst to the luminosity or to the isotropic energy of BW, you extract the Doppler, the delta to the cube, you find exactly that this is just a time stretch picture of the normal gamma ray burst. Just it's a normal gamma ray burst viewed at relative large viewing angle. Radio, let me just finish the comment. The radio is fitting, it has been published also, the radio is very well fitted by a normal radio afterglow of a gamma ray burst, which is jetted and viewed off axis with the same viewing angle.
Right. It may well be that some model like that does apply here. The possible drawback is that the radio has been pursued to quite late times, or one might expect that the gamma ray bursts, that the ejecta have slowed down, so that in fact the beaming becomes quite a bit wider, and one would expect to see more radio emission at late times. I think there's a fairly good late upper limit on the radio emission.
Philip? The situation you described for 2001 EM seems to me very reminiscent of what you might expect from KC mass transfer, where you have a binary action after helium core burning, dynamic mass transfer, and then you eject the common envelope just a few thousand years before the explosion.
Okay.
Does that sound
good? Sounds reasonable to me.
And the electrospectrum you derive for supernovae spectral index in -3 is for these electrons are cooled or
no? I mean,
not time sufficient time to cool them.
In O2 AP, there may be synchrotron cooling occurring, or is it inverse Compton cooling that's occurring there? But if you look at the parameters for the others, the physical situation, it doesn't seem that the electrons are being cooled, that the cooling times are long enough. So what you see should be injected power loss.
So these are relatively low energy, about 10 MeV electrons, I understand, right?
Because they're
Lorentz very low energy particles.
Yeah, they're low energy particles, and because the magnetic field is high, something like a few tenths of a Gauss, so you have very high magnetic field in these cases.
But then situation is quite interesting. I mean, you have, if you don't, the cooling time is long, and you have luminosity in radio at the level of 10 to 39 arc per second, it means you have a huge luminosity in acceleration of electrons, so the huge efficiency acceleration, but at the same time the acceleration doesn't go to very high energy, so somehow basically all acceleration goes to low energy part, like in the sun, but on much larger scales. So it's a bit unusual situation.
Yeah, well, as I argued, you may get flattening of the spectrum at higher energies, and so there could be, in fact, some of the energy does go into high energy particles too, but yeah, a lot of the energy is in the low energy particles.
How well do we know about the properties of the wind of a Wolf Rayet in the last 100 years of its life, which is a more or less a relevant one for GRBs?
Yeah, well, the best estimate we have is that, you know, things are not changing extremely rapidly as far as the the Wolf Rayet properties in the last 10 to 100 years. That according to Norbert, on a timescale of the thermal timescale of 1,000 years or more, or that might be relevant for the binaries also, one might expect some changes in some cases. But the other point is, so at least as a first approximation, one can take the sort of typical densities that one expects based on what you see for, you know, Wolf Rayet stars where you can measure the winds. And the same, as I say, for the type 1Bs, that sort of range of wind densities can be made to fit the observations that we see for the type 1BCs. And things may be, one may have a very special case for the gamma ray burst where it's some kind of weird, rapidly rotating star that we've never, you know, we don't ordinarily see and we don't understand very well. But it's still, in terms of how the density varies with radius, it's hard to think of anything other than the wind bubble type of picture to get the constant density that one sees there.
Hi. You had a view graph showing a radio flare on radio afterglow light curves of a gamma ray burst, which you interpreted as a density jump. Can you go
well,
to the view graph?
You mean 98BW? I mean, there are, I think the only thing somewhat like was this one, so there is this.
That's right. Oh, that's 98BW, okay.
This is 98BW here, so it comes down, and so it's very much like what we see in the O3BD.
You said there's some difficulty getting the steep declines in the temporal decay after the density bump.
Yeah, the argument, if this jump is due to running into a density jump from a termination shock, then one would get a flatter region with a density at larger radius, but there's that doesn't show up in the kinds of light curve shapes that one sees after.
Doesn't that reflect the density post termination shock?
Here.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it could be lower.
Well, if you have a flat density, I'm just saying this is dropping quite fairly steeply here. That's all I'm saying.
So you could have an even diluted density profile beyond the termination shock? No.
Well, we can talk later, maybe.
What's the physical size scale of that bump correspond to then?
This bump?
Yes.
Let's see. In these here, it's around 6 times 10 to the 16 centimeters, I mean, as far as radius from the center.
And is that number special for any reason?
It's a small number. It's a smaller number than you'd expect, in any natural scenario. It's a smaller number than you'd naturally expect structure in the wind.
Yeah. You gave this possible explanation for the constant density medium that the Wolf Rayet wind is still contained by the previous wind.
Yeah.
But in that case, I think that the shocked Wolf Rayet wind region would be extremely narrow. Would that show up as constant density?
Well, it will be narrow. It depends on how dense the circum. You know, if you had really strong mass loss, it seemed to may have occurred in O1 EM. That is, you have several solar masses that are relatively, you know, so if you have a very dense medium, then it acts like a wall and you can build up more of a region. If it's sort of more typical red supergiant mass loss rates, then you're right. Then you drive a shell into that wind. So that's going out ahead, and you don't get much of a region of shocked Wolf Rayet wind. And that would be another problem. You just sort of it wouldn't maybe get an extended flat region, and it wouldn't take very long to get through that region, which would cause problems here.
Thanks.
Exactly.
Yes, it would be just one. Could you please say how significant really is, in your opinion, the presence of those blue-shifted absorption lines? I mean, how many cases?
How significant is what?
best blue shifted absorption lines in GRBs? I mean, how common it is? I mean, should we expect all of them to have it? Or?
Well, it's been seen in a number of sources. I think there's a number of objects that have been looked at where it hasn't been seen also. So it is some fraction. I don't know what the... Right. What she's saying is that you need a high, you need to be looking at relatively high redshift object to get these, because the UV lines are where you want to see the absorption. You need to shift those into the optical. You need to have a fairly bright source to get the high resolution spectroscopy. So it hasn't been done for a lot of objects. And of the ones that has been done for...
I would think maybe 30% show
30%,
them?
30%, yeah. I mean, there's a few... I mean, they're showing up more in the Swift era. I mean, since Swift is seeing high redshift objects, it is finding the kinds of things where it's good for looking at these absorption lines. That's seen in a handful of cases. So there's a few cases. I think I listed some of the numbers, but it's not always... I think that's... There's sometimes very strong absorption features seen, but not the high velocities, and so that's certainly not always seen also.
Kurt?
Thank you. Let me say on 98BW, with our interpretation for the lumps and bumps, the lump starts and then actually ends at a length, as I recall, about 75 days. And then I believe 150 days later, you have these sets of points here, which are consistent. Unfortunately, this gap is quite large. It's more than 200 days, but are consistent with the same sort of bump as this one when you take the log-log scale into account. At all frequencies, you'll notice that point should be down there, and that point should be down there, of a second lump where the length of time that it is on of about, I believe it was 75 days, also fits within the observations because there's just no sampling here. And the time interval, if you assume the best estimate of a couple hundred thousand kilometers per second between these two, is would be a few thousand years in the a relatively slow wind with the shock traveling at almost relativistic speeds, which is similar to what is seen in other supernovae in terms of a time scale. So it does seem to work from two bumps, at least, for a circumstellar medium density enhancement.
Yeah, but you're assuming the wind is 10 kilometers per second, whereas I take more like 1,000, that brings down the time scale by a factor of 100. So that's why in that picture you'd need to have structure on a relatively fast time scale. And it's curious that in this, I mean, this is one high point here at all frequencies, but I sort of worry about just seeing it on one day. I don't know. I mean, you do the radio observations, but here there's clearly a jump here, but then there is another sort of flattening that one sees after 150 days or so, and one sees a very similar feature in the other supernova here. So the there is something going on at later times here too.
Any more questions or remarks? If not, then let's thank the speaker again. We break for coffee and please